Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia. He's a fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. In the 1980s, he documented Iraqi atrocities against the Kurds for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he will be talking to us today both about the sentencing of Chemical Ali to be hanged, but also the persistent idea that Kurdistan could be the model for a new Iraq, and the United States could salvage the disaster in Iraq by moving to the north into the Kurdish area and making that a model. So we'll be looking into the feasibility of the Iraq, the Kurdistan plan. And then we'll talk about the change Supreme Court. It seems that everybody's woken up all of a sudden, and whoops, the Supreme Court's turned to the right. And we'll be talking to Professor David Barron, professor of law at Harvard University. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, whose health a lot of progressives are concerned about, since he's the most likely to retire from the court and therefore give President Bush another chance to move the court even further to the right. And then we'll talk about the CIA's crown jewels, the family jewels, which were released just early in the week. John Prattis is a senior fellow with the National Security Archives. He's the author of Safe for Democracy and The Lost Crusades, The Secret Wars of Bill Colby. And of course, it was William Colby who originally got the agency to look into its own dirty secrets, and they were held up for some time. But now they were made public early this week on Monday. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, a former United States ambassador to Croatia. He served on the Foreign Relations Committee from 79 to 93, and he has also served at the United Nations as an ambassador in East Timor, and he's taught at the National War College, he spent a lot of time in the Kurdish north of Iraq. And in fact, when you were on the Foreign Relations Committee, you went there to document Iraqi atrocities against the Kurds. And there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times this week about your experience, in particularly in terms of the sentencing of Chemical Ali. Just to touch on the op-ed piece, and because I wanted to talk to you further about the extent to which so many people are offering up Kurdistan as a model for the United States to salvage the disaster in Iraq, and indeed in Sunday's New York Times, Thomas Friedman has got an article suggesting that the Kurdish North is the model that the United States should build on for a democratic Middle East, but. Just to go back to history a bit, I recall during the Iran-Iraq war that Henry Kissinger once made the remark that pity both sides can't lose. So there's a feeling in here that even though this was one of the greatest atrocities and a hideous line was crossed with the use of chemical weapons, at the time we really didn't step up to the plate.
No, we certainly didn't. Iraq is the country that engaged in the first sustained use of chemical weapons in violation of the 1925 Geneva Convention banning the use of those chemicals. In fact, it's the only country to violate that treaty. There were some uses of chemical weapons in other instances, notably in the Yemeni civil war in the 1960s. But that actually wasn't technically banned by the convention because that was an internal use. Iran began the use of chemical weapons against the Iranians in 1983, and the United States issued perfunctory denunciations by the State Department spokesman. But at the same time, sent the President Reagan sent Donald Rumsfeld to Iran with a message that the U.S. wanted to build relations with Saddam and open up diplomatic relations, which we did in November of 1984.
And, of course, President Reagan really didn't invoke sanctions, and President Bush actually, George Herbert Walker Bush actually doubled USAID to Iraq.
Well, this is one of the ironies. Iraq began using chemical weapons against Iran in 1983, and then in 1987, Saddam Hussein put his cousin Ali Hassan al-Majid, known as Chemical Ali, in charge of the north of Iraq to deal with a persistent Kurdish rebellion. And he began to use chemical weapons, not so much against the rebels, but against the villagers in the areas where the rebels might operate. And that campaign continued in 1988 with the attack on the city of Halabja, which had been taken over by Kurdish rebels, killed about 5,000 people. Those images were sent around the world because the Iranians who were nearby allowed television cameras to go in and still photographers. And then, at the time of Halabja, the Reagan administration, although they clearly must have known that it was Iraq that did it, put out the word that maybe both Iran and Iraq had used chemical weapons against the Kurds. The Iran-Iraq war ended on the 20th of August, 88, and then 5 days later, in a part of Iraq far from Iran but close to Syria and Turkey, Dahok Governorate, Saddam attacked some 48 villages. This, in response to those attacks, which I went out and documented, the U.S. Senate unanimously cut off U.S. assistance to Iraq. At the time, it was about the fourth largest recipient of U.S. financial assistance, and imposed trade sanctions. Ronald Reagan opposed these sanctions, actually in a position that was coordinated by his national security advisor, Colin Powell. And then the next year, within a year of the gassing of Halabja, within 9 months of these attacks that took place after the end of the Iran-Iraq war, the first President Bush actually doubled U.S. financial assistance to Iraq. And who was sitting on the National Security Council that did that? None other than Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. So while 15 years later, the fact that Saddam had gassed his own people back in 1988 and 1987 became a reason for the second Gulf War. At the time he was actually doing that, neither Reagan, nor the first President Bush, nor Colin Powell, nor Dick Cheney thought that was sufficient reason even to cut U.S. assistance to Iraq.
And of course we've all seen the famous photograph of the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, shaking hands with Saddam at the time when many of these deals were made. Let me turn to the notion that so many people are putting forth, this idea that, well, to begin with, the surge, in many ways, the president appears to be guilty of magical thinking that the surge somehow will change everything and solve all of his problems, and he keeps referring to the general as though he was some sort of miracle worker. And now we're starting to get sort of in the Beltway, people are now sort of chiming in and saying, it's not working, etc. And time and time again, people go back to the idea of the Kurdish North being a model. And in Sunday's New York Times, as I mentioned, Tom Friedman has a piece in that regard. You've been more familiar with that territory than most people. Ambassador Galbraith, what's your give us a reality check.
Well, the first point is that Tom Friedman is right. The north of Iraq, Kurdistan, has been a very major success. It is stable. There have been virtually no terrorist incidents there. It has a robust free press. It is economically booming. In fact, while unemployment in the rest of Iraq hovers between 30% and 50%, in Kurdistan, there's over full employment. They actually have to import laborers, which they don't do from Arab Iraq. They do from the Kurdish regions of Turkey and Iran. It is moving in a democratic direction, and it's a success. The notion that, but there are two points that have to be borne in mind. First, the people of Kurdistan want to have nothing to do with Iraq. They voted 98% for independence in a referendum in 2005. They have their own army. They have their own parliament, their own president. They fly their own flag. They actually ban the flying of the Iraqi flag, and they don't allow the Iraqi army on their territory. So except that it's not a member of the United Nations. It's really not part of Iraq. It functions like a separate country. Secondly, it's not Arab. The Kurds are speak Kurdish as an Indo-European language, but actually most closely linked to Farsi, the language of Iran. And so the notion that Kurdistan is going to be much of a model for the Arab Middle East is not very plausible. In fact, most Arab states see the what has happened in Iraq as the United States breaking up an Arab state, partly because one of the unintended consequences of our intervention was the emergence of this independent Kurdistan.
And how viable would that be if things continue to disintegrate in the Sunni Shiite area, and then the Sunni get ethnically cleansed to Al-Anbar, and obviously the Shiites, and that seems to be the strategic blunder here, that the Bush administration have empowered and emboldened Iran. So what about Turkey hovering there on the northern border?
Well, the question of whether the problem that an independent Kurdistan has on the territory of Iraq is that it's opposed by two powerful neighbors, namely Turkey and Iran. That said, the Turkey has actually had a very sophisticated approach to Iraqi Kurdistan. On the one hand, they insist in their public statements on the territorial integrity of Iraq. And on the other hand, though, they recognize that isn't going to happen, that there is an independent Kurdistan. In fact, General Kenan Evren, who was the last military dictator in Turkey in the early 1980s, he gave an interview. He said, an independent Kurdistan already exists. We have to get used to it. And that's more or less what Turkey has done. The major source of foreign investment in Iraqi Kurdistan comes from Turkey, about 90% of the investment. With the support from the Turkish government, Turkish companies are developing oil in Iraqi Kurdistan under agreements not with the central government in Baghdad, but with the Kurdistan government. So beneath the rhetoric, Turkey has developed a very pragmatic approach, and there are people in Turkey who make the case maybe an independent Kurdistan in Iraq isn't such a bad thing. After all, who are the Kurds? They're secular, they're pro-Western, they aspire to be democratic, and they're not Arabs. In short, they're a lot like the Turks. And beyond that, if it becomes independent, it's going to have to be dependent on somebody, and that somebody is going to be Turkey.
That's where all the oil would be exported through the pipelines that go through Turkey.
Well, that's right, and you would have a secular buffer against an Iranian-dominated Shiite Iraq. That's also something that's attractive to strategic thinkers in Turkey.
So this idea that's continually being floated, that the United States could retreat, to, even though they've built some very solid and permanent bases, if indeed the territory becomes so hostile, it seems unlikely that you could maintain these kind of Fort Apaches, the Camp Croppers and others, and it's also it seems impossible to imagine that you could maintain the supply lines through the Shiite-dominated area down to Kuwait. So in the event that things get worse in Iraq, would the Kurds be open to the idea of huge and permanent U.S. bases on their territory?
Kurdistan is probably the most pro-American place in the world, and very pro-Bush. They love President Bush for the same reason he's become so unpopular every place else. That is, they love him for having screwed up Iraq, a country that they hate. And so they would welcome, and the Kurdistan government has said this very clearly, they would welcome American bases in Kurdistan. The Kurdish people would be very hospitable. There are not many coalition troops in Kurdistan, never have been, because the security has been provided by the Kurdistan Army, known as the Peshmerga. But there haven't been any attacks or any no coalition troops have died in Kurdistan. So, we hope that that record continues. But it is certainly a very hospitable place for the United States.
So what do you think is the, I mean, one of the things that concerns me about the surge and the and what many people see as a sort of inevitable failure or perhaps a fizzle is that if indeed, as many of the young junior officers say, the surge is actually happening on the other side, that the enemy is getting stronger and more aggressive, wouldn't it make sense that, and I know that this possibility is not often discussed, but it seems to me that, and I remember talking recently with General Odom, former head of the NSA and Army Intelligence, and he thought that our military planners were derelict in not planning for the possibility of a military defeat, that we could actually be driven out. So are there contingency plans to go into the north that you know of?
I don't know the extent of U.S. military planning. I know.
I understand,
that,
but I guess my point.
Well, I think I've talked to enough U.S. military officers to know that there's interest in it, and there have been discussions about it. I have to say, though, I think it's very important for your listeners to understand what defeat in Iraq looks like, because there's an image which has been put forward by the president, by Vice President Cheney, some of the neocon writers, that defeat is somehow going to be al-Qaeda chasing the U.S. embassy onto the rooftops where it will be evacuated by helicopters. That isn't how it's going to end in Iraq. Defeat in Iraq is going to look exactly like the situation now, because George Bush lost this war, and defeat means a Shiite religious government closely aligned with Iran. It certainly means a civil war. That's going to be the Shiites cleansing the Sunnis out of Baghdad, and the breakup of the country. But there isn't going to be some other dramatic turn against the United States. We're not going to be chased out. But it's going to be more of the same if we stay there. So it isn't a precipitate moment that's likely to arrive. It's just a recognition that we haven't succeeded. And then I would argue very much along with Tom Friedman and Senator Clinton and some of the others that, yes, we have a moral obligation to the Kurds, who were our allies, who fought on our side in the 2003 war, but also that this is the one successful place in Iraq and that we ought to help protect it. And incidentally, it wouldn't require a large force to protect it. Kurdistan emerged as a de facto independent entity in 1991 after the failed uprising at the end of the first Gulf War, and the U.S. created a safe area. It protected that safe area by air for 12 years. Saddam didn't dare attack. Now the Kurdistan military is much more powerful. We ought to consider arming it. But I would think a small military presence on the ground combined with air support would be more than sufficient to protect Kurdistan.
And just in closing then, Ambassador Galbraith, do you think that, it seems landlocked, so if we had a permanent presence there and to the south you had this roiling civil war going on where the Sunni and the Shia would slug it out until, I guess, the one or both get exhausted, it's hard to see anybody totally triumphing there. So how would the place be supplied and how long would this commitment be for?
Well, first, it could be protected from the air, as it was for 12 years. Obviously, the best way to resupply would be through Turkey, and hopefully the next president of the United States is going to be able to repair the extraordinary damage that this administration did to U.S.-Turkish relations. The Iraqi civil war is only going to end one way, and that's going to be with a Shiite victory. They're three times as numerous as the Sunnis. And so it's also possible that the U.S. will maintain reasonable relations with the Shiites in Iraq, and that, too, could be a method of supply to Kurdistan. Now, obviously, we'll have logistical problems if we try to maintain the current level of force in Kurdistan, but if you reduce it down to a much smaller force, it seems to me you can supply it by air through Iraq, and hopefully with some repair to our relations with Turkey through Turkey.
And you don't expect any things to get exacerbated between the Kurds and the Turks over the elections in Mosul?
Well, they're going to be exacerbated between now and the Turkish elections, which are, I believe, the 22nd of July. And while the irony is that the real issue in the Turkish elections is the military's objection to the Islamic government in Turkey, the card that the military are playing is the national card, and suggesting this government hasn't done enough to oppose the PKK. This is a fringe Kurdish separatist group, which has some members of whom are based in very remote areas in northern Iraq. Now, the issue at the end of the year is that there's going to be a referendum in, not Mosul, but in Kirkuk, which
yes.
is an ethnically mixed city, which the Kurds claim and almost certainly have a majority and therefore would win the referendum. But it has a Turkmen population, ethnic Turks, and an Arab population. Turkey doesn't want to see it part of Kurdistan, partly because they're afraid it will give Kurdistan the economic base for independence, because not only is the city of Kirkuk there, but it lies on one of Iraq's largest oil fields. But that is part of the Iraqi constitution, and so Turkey's ability to complain about the referendum is limited. But there's no doubt there's going to be a rough period between now and the Turkish elections in July and between now and the referendum at the end of the year. After we get through that, and particularly after we have a new administration in the United States, I think there may be a whole different possibility for a whole different relationship between Kurdistan and Turkey and between the United States and Turkey.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Well, very good being with you again.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who's former United States Ambassador to Croatia, and he's a fellow with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And in the 1980s, he documented Iraqi atrocities against the Kurds for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and then later took custody of the files of Chemical Ali, who's now been sentenced to hang. I'm speaking with Professor David Barron, who's professor of law at Harvard University, and you also clerked for Justice Stevens, Professor Barron. Of course, many people are concerned about the health of Justice Stevens, because presumably if he were to retire, the President Bush would have yet another chance. He's already appointed two people to the court, the Chief Justice Roberts and Samuel Alito. I must say, with the front page story in Sunday's New York Times, in big steps and small, Supreme Court has moved to the right. Isn't it a little late in the day for people to be waking up to the obvious?
Well, in one sense, yes, because both appointees by President Bush were, as advertised, very conservative, and a close reading of their records at the time of their confirmation, Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, would have indicated that much. On the other hand, a part of the sales job during the confirmation by both justices was to suggest that they were not radicals, they weren't ideologues, they were lawyers, and they would be following precedent and acting carefully and just calling, as Chief Justice Roberts put it, balls and strikes like any umpire would. And their demeanor and their obvious legal acumen made it difficult to overcome the story they were telling about themselves and to demonstrate that they were much more ideological as a legal matter than it may have seemed at the time.
Well, I understand that recently Ruth Bader Ginsburg made a remark to the effect that the court is no longer about the law, it's about politics, that it really has become a political court.
I mean, I have to say, stepping back a little bit from the current fight over the direction that the court's going on, it's the case that there will often be charges from the side that's in the minority, that the side that's in the majority when you have a closely fractured court, as we do now, is playing politics rather than law. And liberals were accused of that for a long time. Whenever there was a liberal decision, it's always charted out from Scalia and others that it's just politics. And I think we sort of matured, I hope, intellectually enough to realize that law is an open field in many cases, and it's subject to interpretation, and people have different views of it. And rather than just accusing one side or the other of politics, I think it's more important to get into the substance of the decision-making. And I think some of the decisions that have been issued betray a lack of understanding of the reality of the circumstances that people face. And that, to me, is the most troubling aspect of many of the decisions that came down this term.
So expand on that, if you will, Professor Barron. I mean, do you think that this court is is responding to the realities of
so
the challenges?
So just a couple of things that I think give you an indication that they have a very mechanistic and unrealistic conception in some cases as to what the reality on the ground is. So, for example, there's a woman who's suing for employment discrimination, and she doesn't know that discrimination happened. She finally learns that it has happened years and years before, so she files suit, and employer says you're not allowed to file suit because you only had 180 days from the moment we actually discriminated against you to file your claim. And now it's been almost a decade. Well, of course, she never knew that she was being discriminated against until this point in time, and no one in the case was disputing that fact. And yet, a majority of the court, 5-4, says if you don't figure it out within 180 days of the time they discriminate against you, you're stuck with the burdens of that discrimination for as long as you keep the job. That just seems an incredibly formal way of thinking about our anti-discrimination laws. Even the agency of the federal government charged with enforcing it didn't take that position, and that's the Bush administration. And I think even in the school desegregation cases, which is a much more significant story, you see a similar type of thing where the court just keeps repeating this mantra in Chief Justice Roberts' decision that if you want to stop discrimination, the way to do it is to stop discriminating. But no one who lives in any metropolitan area thinks that you can get over segregation and the reality of segregation in our public school system by simply not doing anything because of the segregated housing patterns that everyone recognizes. And similarly, in the recent abortion case, the majority of the court says that the reason the partial birth abortion restriction is constitutional is in part because women would regret the decision to engage in such a practice if they really thought about it, notwithstanding the fact that there were women who were suing saying that they really want to have this option. So there's a troubling aspect to me in which the real concerns of people are being ignored by the court and a majority of the court that's of concern.
Well, in the last case, I think it's the majority are basically making up medicine. I mean, they're obviously they're in the wrong profession here, because from what I understand about the so-called partial birth abortion situation, it's a very rare occurrence when women have a fetus that's hideously deformed with a huge and misshapen head. And that it's really comes down to a fundamental choice between the health of the mother and the viability of the fetus.
Yeah, and this was disregarding the doctors and the overwhelming consensus of the health community in favor of a finding by the federal Congress, which hadn't exactly distinguished itself in medical judgments, given the Schiavo bill that had been passed some years before. So in my view, more than the charge that it's politics or not politics, I think it's a particular view of the constitutional framework and of law and how it relates to ordinary people that there's a battle over. And there's four clearly on one side that we typically in our current politics call conservative, and there's four that are on the liberal side, and there's one man in the middle, and that's Justice Kennedy. I think if there's a good news for people of a more progressive bent in the term, it's that it seems to me Justice Kennedy has not been captured or persuaded fully at all by Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts. I don't think they've moved him to the right. I think the mix of cases that's come before the court this term, particularly at the end, were cases that Justice Kennedy's own jurisprudential history suggests were ones he would have come out on the conservative side. On race cases, he's always been sympathetic to a relatively colorblind view of the Constitution, and in a sense, he may have been pushed marginally to the left by the extreme language in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the school segregation cases, which is why he took made a point of writing a separate opinion in which he distanced himself from some of the conservative four's views on that issue. In the global warming case, of course, Justice Kennedy went with the liberals. In the war powers cases, he's shown himself to have done the same, and just recently the court reversed itself and decided to take the Guantanamo case. And I noticed the Justice Department said they were disappointed with that decision by the court, which signals to me that they agree with what I think most experts think, which is that Justice Kennedy in those cases is a lot less sympathetic to unfettered executive power than Chief Justice Roberts, Alito, and the others are.
Well, surprise, surprise. Both Chief Justice Roberts and Associate Justice Alito are both former presidential lawyers.
Yeah, that's true. But I guess as a former presidential lawyer myself, I think it's possible to have had such a job and to still believe that there are limits in our system on the president. Of course, one of the most famous presidential lawyers of all time was Justice Robert Jackson. And he wrote the famous opinion in the Steele seizure case saying that President Truman had no constitutional power to seize the steel mills in a time of war. So I don't think there's anything about being a presidential lawyer that makes you believe in the kind of strong form of unfettered executive power that the Bush administration asserts, and that, at least judging from Chief Justice Roberts' opinion when he was on the D.C. Circuit in the military tribunals case, he seems somewhat partial to.
Well, you didn't exactly say this, Professor David Barron, that the justices are injecting personal opinions into this case, or their own personal politics or prejudices or predilections. But it does seem that way, given that there's a sort of religious consistency here to many of these decisions that come down. The bonging for Jesus one, the taxpayer money for the faith-based initiatives.
Yeah. Well, I do think the bonging for Jesus one, I think, is, in my own view, a case where I think it's pretty unpersuasive legal analysis by the majority. In restricting the student speech there, they essentially say there's a illegal drug exception to the First Amendment, which I'm not usually sympathetic to. People say if you look at the text of the First Amendment, you can't find that in it. But in this case, you really can't find that in it, and it does seem to me that's not very much more than a policy predilection. I think in these other cases, though, there's something more that's going on. I don't think it's just purely outcome-driven. I think it's different attitudes about how we think about what law is supposed to do in society, how much it's supposed to be understood in the very narrow technical sense that assumes that law is not trying to help those in need, versus people who read it with much more of a sense that part of our system is equal justice under the law, with an eye towards making sure that it's read in a open and just fashion, so that people who are suffering real burdens and can call upon a disinterested neutral judge to protect them in those circumstances. That's a fundamental divide. It's been a divide since Chief Justice Warren was on the Supreme Court almost a half a century ago. And in those 50 years, there's been a real concerted effort to question the legitimacy of Chief Justice Warren's approach, which was to ask at the base of many of these cases is what's fair. That's been sort of mocked and lampooned as an idea in law by many on the conservative side of these debates. And I think they've now got justices in place who come out of that much more conservative tradition. And as a consequence, they're voting consistent with their own jurisprudential beliefs. But as I say, that tradition has not won the day. I think it had a good term this term, but it's still the case that there are four people, Breyer, Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg, who come out of a very different tradition, some of them civil rights lawyers, other of them working for Congress, one for Senator Kennedy, who have a much different idea of law, one much more consonant with the Warren tradition. And in the middle of this is Justice Kennedy, who has shown real sympathy for extending our constitutional structure to be inclusive in gay rights cases, who's been concerned about the separation of powers and broad assertions of executive authority in the military tribunal cases, but who also has really strong views that line up with the conservatives on race cases and in the abortion area. And depending on the mix of cases that comes up to the court, I think that will that will make it seem that the court is lurching way to the right or then shifting back towards the left. I think the reality is we've got two pretty well-defined blocks on the court of four justices and one person who's very much distance himself to some extent from each side.
And in terms of the 5-4 breakdown on abortion rights, speech, pay discrimination, taxpayer money, school desegregation, mm-hmm. campaign finance, criminal law, and price floors, you don't think that there's any consistency there, given that all these five justices are all very conservative Catholics. I mean, some of them are much more so than Scalia is, but Roberts, Thomas, and Kennedy.
Well, I think there are those four, and whether it's their Catholicism or their jurisprudential beliefs, you know, who can ever really know the answer to those?
What about the Federalist Society?
Question, but I mean, I think they are very conservative positions that they're taking. I just caution you, though, on that, because, of course, Justice Kennedy, who's been with those four on all of those cases, making it a five-vote majority, also took the position in the Lawrence case to overrule Bowers versus Hardwick, which was maybe the most anti-gay rights decision by the Supreme Court ever, and took a great deal of criticism from the Federalist Society and others for making that ruling. So I just think the picture is not quite as stark as we might suggest. But I think maybe the thrust of your question is, look, we've had two new people added, Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, and many people said, oh, they're just straight judges. It's not going to make a difference in the outcome of any cases. That's just transparently not true now. We know that those justices are, as it appears, very conservative justices. Chief Justice Roberts votes almost 90% of the time in divided cases with Justice Scalia, who no one confuses as anything other than a conservative justice. And so it's definitely the case that those two votes has shifted the balance to some extent. It seems like Chief Justice Roberts is much more conservative than even his mentor, Chief Justice Rehnquist, was at the time Rehnquist left the court. Rehnquist started very, very conservative, but to some extent moderated over time. And it seems like Chief Justice Roberts is more in the mold of where Justice Rehnquist began his tenure on the court than where he ended it. And Justice Alito is quite clearly a more conservative justice, at least after two terms, than Justice O'Connor proved herself to be at the time she left the court. So in that sense, it shifted. And then finally, I guess I'd just add, Chief Justice Roberts made a lot out of the idea that he was going to be a uniter, not a divider, when he came to the Supreme Court, much in the way that the president appointed him, suggested he too would be a uniter, not a divider. And really the most striking thing about these two terms is that the court now is, if anything, more divided than it was 2 years ago.
Well, just in closing then, when you hear these terms like original intent and judicial activism, a lot of the buzzwords in this argument, I think it seems to be pretty straightforward in terms of the conservative bloc that they vote for the rich over the poor, the powerful over the alienated, the business over labor, and the corporation over the consumer. I mean, isn't there a consistency there?
You know, at one level, that if you step back and look at it, one could say yes, but I think all these cases are a little more complex, and part of the job being a law professor, I guess, is to push those complexities. But if you say they vote for the rich over the poor, I mean, it's a little bit complicated, even in a case like the McCain-Feingold campaign finance case, where, of course, the actual plaintiff there is the Wisconsin Right to Life, which is not a particularly rich institution. It's a nonprofit organization. And there are people who are civil libertarians who think that campaign finance regulation of that kind is misguided. So I think it's a little bit too simple to say that. And then also one has to admit that in the business cases, many of them are decided by 8-1 majorities, with sometimes only Justice Stevens in dissent. So it's not as if the liberal bloc is consistency ruling against corporations. But I do think there's a reason why we're able to say, without anybody really disputing it, that we have conservative justices and liberal justices, and that's because the outcomes that result from their jurisprudential ideas line up with our current politics. So when you hear that the court has struck down race-based school assignment aimed at integrating long-standing segregated metropolitan areas, it sounds like you would guess, gee, it must be a pretty conservative set of justices that are on the court. Similarly, when you hear that they've determined that a federal regulation of a woman's right to choose has been upheld, again, one can say pretty confidently that, gee, it must be a pretty conservative court. And in fact, I think that's true.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Professor David Barron.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Professor David Barron. He's a professor of law at Harvard University. He clerked for Supreme Court Associate Justice John Paul Stevens, the justice whose health many progressives are concerned about. I'm now speaking with John Pradas, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Archives, and he's the author of Safer Democracy and the Lost Crusades, the secret wars of Bill Colby. And it was, after all, Bill Colby who generated, I guess, the family jewels that were just released this week by the CIA through, and the National Security Archives were the main protagonists in getting this stuff released, John Pradas. How did these documents get generated in the first place? I understand that Colby, when he was the DCI, basically told everybody in the building, write your confession. Is that
right? Well, that's the front side of the story, but the back story is about Watergate, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Colby was the agency's executive director at this time in 1973. He didn't take over as a director until later that year. But he was traveling in Thailand doing an inspection of CIA stations when a Watergate story hit that a former CIA officer, James McCord, was threatening to tell all, and another one, Howard Hunt, was giving certain grand jury testimony about agency help to them, that the director at that time, a man named James Schlesinger, didn't know anything about. And Schlesinger was furious and called up Colby and said, "What the hell else haven't you told us about?" And when Colby got back to town, they cooked up this order that you refer to, which went out to everybody at the CIA and said, tell us everything that you've been involved in or even have heard about that could potentially be illegal or even have so-called flap potential.
Hmm. So what about, you mentioned Hunt, so I just wanted to follow up on that. You know, I've been getting lots of letters from people wanting me to investigate, to talk to his son about his deathbed confession that somehow the CIA was involved in the assassination of Kennedy. I mean, I imagine you've looked into that. Is there?
Well, not in the family jewels, certainly.
Right.
As far as the Kennedy assassination is concerned, the family jewels does not have anything directly. On operations against Castro, what it has is all about CIA relationships with the mafia in the United States, principally Johnny Rosselli, but there are other figures on the sidelines there, like Giancana and those people.
Mm-hmm. And Rosselli ended up in a oil drum floating off the Florida beaches, right?
That's where Rosselli ended up, that's right.
And who do you think canceled his ticket?
Well, I don't want to say, actually.
Yeah. Well, I was at, there was a, of course, an earlier book about the Mandarins, the five that started the agency that dealt with Desmond Fitzgerald in Paris, dealing with a Cuban defector.
That's right, and that's an example of how imperfect the family jewels is. The story of Fitzgerald with Q.J. Wynn, another one of these Castro assassination figures, right?
Right, Colonel Cabela, right.
You know, it's not in there.
Yeah.
That'll just
make people feel like the whole truth and nothing but the truth is being told.
There is, in fact, a massive detailed study that was done by the CIA Inspector General in 1967, which is already in the public domain, a previous version of it having been declassified. And one of the things that I expected to see in the family jewels when it was released was a new version of that paper without all the deletions. But in fact, the family jewels doesn't contain that paper.
Hmm.
So it raises questions, actually, about how this report was really compiled, you know, because it doesn't really represent the sum total of what was going on. It really represents the total of what various CIA office directors thought that they should tell Jim Schlesinger. Mm-hmm. Now, it just so happens Schlesinger was an agency outsider and not highly trusted at the agency. And when he came into CIA, the first thing he did was start to implement a post-Vietnam reduction in the agency. So
No doubt a lot of CIA officers already saw their jobs on the line, and their reluctance to talk to Jim Schlesinger would only have been increased thereby. So I'm forced to conclude that the Family Jewels is a very imperfect document. In fact, we could assemble from the declassified record today Family Jewels 2.0, which would tell the story through CIA's own documents much more clearly than this one does.
So is there anything in this, John Pratis? I know it seems to me that most of it is the stories that we're aware of, and, you know, the Gottlieb's LSD experiments in San Francisco and stuff like this has been pretty well known for a while. Anything in there then that caught your attention?
Yes, absolutely. Despite the fact that, you know, some of this is dotting the I's and crossing the T's on other stories, there's some radically new information. For example, after the U.S. invasion of Cambodia in 1970, the Nixon White House forced the CIA to pay for political mail, White House political mail. It had the CIA reimburse the cost for the White House answering letters to Mr. Nixon after the speech that he gave announcing his invasion of Cambodia. That was a clear pulling of the agency across the boundary between government activity and political action in a very concrete way. That's one thing. Another thing is evidence of a CIA infiltration of another U.S. government agency, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Granted that this was at the request of the director of the BNDD, who thought that there was some bad apples in his own organization and didn't trust his own security people to take care of the problem. Nevertheless, he's asking another U.S. agency to infiltrate a different one. A third element that's new is not direct evidence, but a story that the CIA itself sort of couldn't get to the bottom of, that was told by one of its own officers at a training session about CIA officers participating in a bust in Montgomery County, Maryland in 1973, which, if that were true, would mean that, in fact, the CIA directly violated its charter in engaging in police activities inside the United States.
What was the nature of this bust?
A Montgomery County resident apparently had been overheard threatening to go and take out, quote-unquote, a policeman. Not an action by that person, but a threat which somehow was known to the police, and the police took an essentially preventative action. So I don't know about the legality at all of the criminal activity that's alleged here, but beyond that, if a CIA officer had participated in this bust in any fashion, that would have crossed the agency's boundaries.
And in terms of the files that they kept on journalists, there's quite a bit of attention being given to that. Is there anything much there? I mean, I've tried to interview Ed Applewhite. I don't know whether you have, but it's pretty hard to get these guys to talk.
Well, that's absolutely true. I think there's new detail there on the in general, on the investigations of Anderson and Company, because the extracts from the director of the CIA's morning staff meetings that are included in the Family Jewels include notes from the day when he issued the order to go out and surveil Anderson. So that's one. Or is it Michael Gettler? It's Michael Gettler, actually. Anderson is alluded to, but the order is not directly quoted. The other one is Project Mockingbird, the 1962-63 surveillance of other U.S. journalists. There's new data on that in there. Oh, I should say, too, on the subject of what's absolutely new in these Family Jewels, stories of how extensive CIA help was to White House operatives and the Secret Service in terms of their preparations to monitor protests at the 1972 Republican presidential convention in Washington, in Miami, Florida.
So, in terms of the politics of the release, we know that these documents were generated a long time, and that essentially during the Church Committee days, when much was aired, Henry Kissinger basically held this stuff back. What's General Hayden's motive, and how does it relate to what's happening today? Because there's enormous questions looming out there of the inordinate power of the vice president. There was a series of articles in the Washington Post titled Angler about the vice president. He controls the intelligence portfolio. It was given to him by the president. So in this current climate, we don't know what the vice president's up to. At the same time, the director of Central Intelligence is doing this data dump. So it's a little confusing.
I think the CIA is in the mode of trying to curry favor here in the midst of the pressure that it's under for allegations about its current activities. I think that it failed to anticipate precisely what the response would be to this set of releases that it's made. You know, alongside the family jewels collection of documents, the agency also released a pretty extensive set of Russia and China analytical studies, much more extensive, in fact. The family jewels is about 700 pages long, and there's 11,000 pages of this other material that has gathered practically no interest whatsoever. I think that the agency anticipated that the Chinese and Soviet documents were going to get all the interest, and the family jewels was going to be a by-the-way thing. And instead, of course, the response has been precisely the reverse. So I think they seriously miscalculated there.
And
I think one reason why is precisely because you can see in the family jewels evidence that way back then, the CIA was doing similar kinds of things to the kinds of things it's accused of doing today. So it strikes a chord rather than the China-Russia documents that are just more of what the CIA feels comfortable talking about and has released a great deal of in the past.
And do these, the China and Soviet documents, would they would bolster the case that the CIA was not blindsided by the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, this particular collection of documents ends long before the collapse of the Soviet Union.
I see. So it's just about
in the 1970s that it ends,
right.
Essentially.
So it details Russia's threats to bomb Lop-Nor and stuff like that, I guess.
No, what it does is it's like an internal guide kind of a thing for CIA analysts and officers who are entering on duty that they can read into what the agency thinks it knows about Russia. So it talks about Russian decision-making. It talks about who's ahead in the Politburo.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about whether the Sino-Soviet split is real, those kinds of issues.
I see. Well, again, relating this to the current, particularly those articles in the Post about the vice president, I know that got a lot of people's attention in Washington. What's this feeling then that the agency is releasing, coming clean on the one hand, and there's all of this sort of opaqueness about the extent to which Dick Cheney's basically running amok.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, there's a whole other untold story about the family jewels, and that is what happened when they were released. I mean, not released. I mean, when this first became an issue, excuse me, when Seymour Hersh published an article in the New York Times about CIA domestic spying in December 1974, the White House's lead person responding to that, which was, in effect, a revelation of the existence of the family jewels, and thus it started that whole ball rolling. The White House's point person in responding to that was Dick Cheney.
Well, that's an interesting note to end.
In the guise of Deputy Chief of Staff in the White House.
Sure. Interesting note to end on, and I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, John Pratis.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Yep.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with John Pratis, a senior fellow at the National Security Archives, who are in part responsible for the release of the CIA's family jewels. He's the author of Safe for Democracy and the Lost Crusades, The Secret Wars of Bill Colby. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, associate producer, Elliot Fon, the assistant producer, Tamika Zoghi, the engineer.